Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Lights, camera, action. Welcome to another episode of the Film and Water Podcast. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me on the show to talk about the 1941 Orson Welles classic, Citizen Kane, is the host of the Comic Book Bears podcast, Bill Zanowitz. Bill, how you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing there, Rob?
Great. And also with us is former guest star of the Fire and Water podcast, John Trumbull. John, hello.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me.
Awesome. Yes. As like I said, we are going to be talking about Citizen Kane, one of my all-time favorite films, and a movie that many have called the greatest film of all time. Bare bones story. Orson Welles plays Charles Foster Kane, a billionaire newspaper tycoon. The film opens with him dying and saying his final word.
Rosebud.
And then a reporter, played by William Allen, is commissioned to find out what that word meant. And we are then treated to Charles Foster Kane's life story through his two different wives, the people that worked with him, the people that raised him. And it's I don't know what to say. You know what? Let's just start with you, Bill. Why do you love Citizen Kane so much?
Well, it isn't so much a case of love as appreciate. I think Citizen Kane is one of those pieces of art that breathes sort of very rarefied air. Other ones I can think of are Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and Watchmen, in that they are innovative, and that innovation comes at a particular point in time, almost the perfect point in time, where it is undoubtedly a watershed event, and there's a before and an after. And before Watchmen, I didn't mean to make that pun. In some ways, works like that are sort of beyond criticism. In terms of loving the film, I appreciate the film. It's nothing apart from two or three bits I never really was emotionally engaged in. It's not a film that tugs on your heartstrings, I think. And that can come in, you know, many sorts of shapes and forms in cinema outside of something sentimental. But just in terms of the visual and audio overload that you get with this film, it has to be appreciated for the landmark that it is.
That's interesting. Yeah, I do consider it kind of more of a brain film than a heart film necessarily. John, what about you?
I think I'm a little closer to love than Bill is from what he's describing, but I agree. I mean, it's a seminal film in terms of the techniques that it did and that it pioneered. And like, I think a lot of people these days, when they go back and look at it, they might not be impressed by it because it's the stuff that was done for the first time in Kane has been used in so many other films. And you have to say like, oh, but you know, this is the first time that a lot of that stuff was done. And that makes it certainly very historically significant. I was thinking last night that, you know, Citizen Kane was 1941, and you compare it with like two other famous films from that same era, Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind from 1939. Those were both shot much more conservatively than Citizen Kane. And if you compare it with other films of that era, you can see how adventurous it was at the time.
Yeah, I mean, before I even get into that, I have to build for a moment, Bill, when you compared it to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, I thought you meant the movie.
Oh, Sergeant, God, no.
I was like, why did I invite Bill on? He really thinks Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the movie, is as good as Citizen Kane. What is happening?
Well, you know, the Bee Gees, they were very, very good in that film.
You know what Citizen Kane needed? More Peter Frampton, you know?
Sure, like, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of movie where I have to think that if you're introducing Citizen Kane to someone for the first time, probably the worst thing you could do for the movie is to tell this person it's the greatest film ever made. Because you're setting it up for failure. On the DVD, there is two different commentary tracks that are available, one by Peter Bogdanovich and one by Roger Ebert. And the Roger Ebert one is superb. He was just so much fun to listen to, and he clearly loves the film. And he mentions about how, you know, that Citizen Kane used all of the things available, both video and audio, that mm-hmm. were available as of 1941 and put them all in one film. And it was something similar to what D.W. Griffith did in 1915 with Birth of a Nation. But the problem is nobody wants to watch Birth of a Nation anymore for pleasure because it's such a disgusting racist film. You watch it for its appreciation for its art form, but not because you really, really want to watch the thing. But Citizen Kane, you know, took all of those things, put them together in one place and sort of pointed forward. And as you said, John, every other film is borrowing it. I kind of felt that way about the first time I saw Casablanca. I didn't see Casablanca until I was in my 20s. And when I watched it, I'm like, boy, this dialogue is corny. And it's like, well, no, it's corny because it's been so enmeshed in the culture 60 years later.
Right.
That it seems, you know, when this dialogue was in this movie, this is the first time this dialogue had been said. And it was, you know, so memorable that it stuck in everybody's brains. And so pretty much any shot, any time anybody composites something, you know, puts a piece of a film next to a piece of live film next to a background painting next to, you know, it's because of Citizen Kane. It's because Orson Welles put all this stuff together.
Right. When you think of things like the low angles and parts where the audio overlaps other elements,
mm-hmm.
You never saw that before.
Yeah.
This film. I mean, I'm sure there's some historian somewhere that could dig something up. But in terms of a Hollywood film of some recognition, this stuff was brand new. Something like that you've seen 1,000 times or heard 1,000 times since then, you take it for granted. You don't think of the introduction of it. And there's so many technical elements that were either introduced or refined in this film that it's easy to, as you said, with Casablanca to kind of dismiss it.
Well, and I think with like some of the audio techniques, like what Bill was saying with the overlapping dialogue and stuff, that's some stuff that you didn't see or hear again in movies until like somebody like Robert Altman started doing it in like the late 60s, early 70s. So, I mean, that sort of shows you how ahead of his time Welles was in many ways. You know, it took years, in some cases decades, for some people to catch up to him.
Yeah, I can't imagine what it must have been like to see this movie for the first time in 1941. I mean, even when you watch the opening credits, the title comes up with no audio. It's just Citizen Kane. And just that, if you watch just that piece nowadays, aside from the fact that it's black and white, you might not even realize this is an older film. It feels modern. It feels like the opening credits, at least, could have been done in 2015, despite the fact this film is now, you know, 70-plus years old. I mean, part of the reason you have to think that, in terms of giving everybody a little background who hasn't seen the film, is one of the reasons it remains such a pure expression of sort of creativity is that Orson Welles was brought to Hollywood. He had been a huge star on radio. He, of course, was the guy behind the War of the Worlds, where the nation got scared into thinking we were being attacked by alien invaders. And RKO brought him over to Hollywood and gave him carte blanche. And he had final edit of this film. Literally, the film went out the way he wanted it to go out, with no oversight from – not oversight, but no really power for RKO to edit it. And, you know, many people considered – said it's the greatest film ever made. He continued to make superb films after this, The Magnificent Ambersons, The Stranger, Lady from Shanghai, Touch of Evil. But all of them suffered a little at the hands of other people who had the ability to edit it. Citizen Kane remains unique in that it was – you know, it went out exactly how Welles saw it, which is sort of remarkable. And as I mentioned, the plot, you know, what drives the story is the word Rosebud. And we're all trying to figure out, what does Rosebud mean? And the reporter, played by William Allen, who was an actor in Welles's Mercury Theater Company, who later went on to produce films. He actually wasn't so much an actor. He ended up producing films like The Creature of the Black Lagoon and The Mole People. He plays Mr. Thompson, who goes from person to person trying to find out, what's Rosebud? What does Rosebud mean? And each person in this film, there's Joseph Cotten as his friend Jedediah Leland, Dorothy Cummingore as his second wife Susan Kane, Agnes Moorhead as his mother, Ruth Warwick as his first wife, Ray Collins as J.W. Geddes, who was a political boss that Kane runs afoul of, Erskine Sanford, Edward Sloan, Paul Stewart. all of these people add some little piece to the puzzle as to what Rosebud might mean. And each of these people gives a tremendous performance. I mean, is there any – for each one of you guys, is there any particular – I mean, the film is fairly segmented as Thompson goes from person to person to person and then doubles back. Is there any particular person that stands out to you outside of Wells himself?
I think my personal favorite is probably Joseph Cotten as Jed Leland. You know, I think that's a really great performance because he starts out like he and Kane are the best of friends. They're old school buddies. And he, over the course of his flashback, becomes slowly disillusioned with Kane as Kane changes over the years. And I think, you know, it's a pretty marvelous performance by Cotton. And I'm sure the fact that he and Wells were real life friends
right.
helped color that too.
Yeah, I mean, they did two films together, and the other one is The Third Man, which is also one of the greatest films ever made. So they really had to touch those guys when they worked together. What about you, Bill?
I'd have to give it to Ruth Warwick in that with her character, we see the biggest emotional change. And that the breakfast scene, that's something that should be taught in every acting 101 class. Of exchange and give and take, and sometimes it's nonverbal, sometimes it's just the positioning of a particular limb that conveys more than 70,000 words could.
Yeah,
I think out of all the performances in the film, hers is the most varied, apart from maybe Wells himself.
Yeah, in terms of the breakfast scene that you mentioned, again, for people who haven't seen it, it's basically that it's Kane marries marries Emily Monroe Norton, who is the daughter of a president. And they suggest that when Kane is through, there she'll be the wife of a president, because that's really where he's headed. And the first scene you see of them, they're having breakfast together at this tiny table, and they're just complete honeymooning. They love each other. And then we flash forward a little, and we see that they're arguing now, and they're sitting a little further apart. Then we flash further again, and they're still arguing, and they're even further apart. And then finally, it ends with them at opposite ends of this ridiculously long table, each of them reading different newspapers. Kaney's reading his own paper. Emily's reading a different newspaper that she's not interested in reading her husband's paper. And they're not talking to each other at all. And it sums up an entire marriage in basically a couple of flash forwards. Mm-hmm. The economy of which how to which Orson tells the story is just remarkable. And to me, no matter how many times I watch it, it still feels very fresh. It doesn't. Maybe partly because it doesn't tell a story in a straightforward nature that you never – I don't know. To me, there's no parts of this film you kind of get bored at. You know?
Right.
It just – no matter where you come in on it, you're like, oh, this is a great scene. And you just go from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it is exceedingly discontinuous, the film. And I think that's a way of keeping you awake in a sense.
But it's also a marvelously structured film because, like Rob, I watched Ebert's commentary the other night that – prepare for this, and he makes a great point that the newsreel at the very beginning, which was a parody of the March of Time newsreels that were very prevalent at the time, it gives you the basic outline of Kane's life. So that gives you the structure going into the film, so you don't really get lost as you have all these interweaving flashbacks throughout the rest of the film. You're just like, oh yeah, this is roughly where this takes place. And that really preps you going into the film, so you don't get lost because you have that basic outline of his life.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there are in this film flashbacks within flashbacks. You know, there are characters remembering other characters' memories. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Is that the whole movie is told right in the beginning. The whole story of Orson of Kane's life is right there. And now you're like, okay, well now I'm oriented. It's a marvel. I mean, Wells won the Oscar for screenplay, along with Joseph Mankiewicz, the only Oscar he ever won. Wells apparently tried to get solo credit, but Mankiewicz sort of forced him into getting co-credit. And I've never read – there's a book about Pauline Kael called Raising Kane, which is apparently about the history of making – I've never read that book. I should read it. From what people have said, it seems like that the film is – in terms of screenplay, it's just as much Mankiewicz's work as it was Wells's work.
Yeah,
and you know, really is kind of a novel structure of how to build a film, and I don't think I've ever seen another movie like that has that particular kind of setup.
Well, Ebert made the point in his commentary. He said, like, you know, Titanic was actually a little similar, because like that opens, they tell you what exactly happened in the wreck, and then when it happens later in the film, you know exactly what's happening and why.
Oh, that's true, right? They're telling Rose, they're telling Gloria Stewart, hey, this is what happened, even though you were there, this is what happened. That's true.
Right, right. I thought that was an interesting parallel.
Yeah, I mean, and the film is filled with so many visual little, I don't want to say gags, because that sort of undercuts them a little, but these things that suggest the mood of the characters visually. And it's the kind of thing where you pick up on it or you might not. I mean, there's a scene where we're flashing way forward to where Kane has basically squandered his fortune, and he's turning over all of his dealings to one of his
Thatcher,
yeah, his guardian, and
banker.
His banker, right? And he's turning over all of his holdings. And in the foreground, he's there with Thatcher and Wells and Everett Sloan playing Mr. Bernstein, who is the lifelong dedicated person to Kane. He just thinks Charles Foster Kane is the greatest person ever. And as Kane's contract is being signed, as all of his fortune is being handed over, he recedes into the background and he heads toward a window. In the background of on the back wall, and then you realize that the window is about 15 feet off the ground, which would not make sense in any room that you've ever been in. But all of a sudden, it makes Kane look tiny. And when you see him in the foreground, you don't get that sense that the window is any higher off the ground than any other window. But then he recedes into it, and you realize, oh, he's now this tiny, tiny little figure. And it's all of these things that I don't know how much the first time I saw the film, or the second time, or the third time, that I necessarily picked all that up. But I imagine it's stuff that you pick up subliminally. Mm-hmm. That you come away with it in the back of your head without thinking about it consciously. And it's nice to have somebody like Roger Ebert to point it out. But I think the first couple of times – I mean, the first time I ever saw Citizen Kane, I loved it. I loved it immediately, and because it just – it feels like this mystery that is being unraveled for you, and yet – you don't really get all the pieces, because, of course, we learn at the end. I don't even should I spoil it? Does it matter? Does anybody?
I think most people know.
Most people know. Rosebud is the sled. Is his childhood sled, which you see in the beginning, which was taken from him when he was a young boy. But that doesn't really explain a whole lot. I mean, it's like, okay, he was upset that he was lost his sled as a child. What does that really? Does that really explain his life? And of course it doesn't, because no one's life can really be explained with one object or anything like that. But it's a film that sort of draws you in, but then keeps you at a distance simultaneously. And I think there's something about that, about the unanswerableness of it, that keeps it sort of, again, sort of keeps it fresh the way a lot of other films maybe don't.
Yeah. I think it's an amazing film, just again on a technical level, because he does so many interesting things, like visually and structurally, you know, the way it skips around in time, and even audio techniques that he brought in from radio, from his radio days, like, you know, when he's in the big mansion towards the end of the film in Xanadu, and they use this echo to just show how huge and empty his life has become, and that, you know, it works on a subliminal level almost. And he also has like a lot of interesting stagecraft stuff where, like with the lighting or with just like background matte paintings and things, he makes it look like it's a much bigger or higher budgeted film than it actually is.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there were scenes of crowds that there's one scene where he's giving a political speech.
Yeah.
And it looks like he's speaking to thousands of people. And it was actually just a painting with mm-hmm. some lights punched in it that flickered and gave the illusion of it being a big crowd. And that's, you know,
he's got like 20 people on stage, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it's this epic looking film made for fairly cheap. Mm-hmm. You know, RKO was not a huge outfit. And so he managed to pull this incredibly huge scoped movie, and it really didn't spend a whole lot of the playfulness by which, you know, a lot of Wells sort of took to this film can be seen also in the trailer for the film has no footage of the movie itself. It's just Orson, who does not appear on camera in the trailer at all, talking to his cast, and like they're goofing around, and at one point he says something to Joseph Cotten, and Joseph Cotten, you could tell, just is genuinely laughing. He's not mm-hmm. he's not acting laughing. He's genuinely laughing.
Yeah.
And at the end of the film, you know, all the cast gets their own little cards. Joseph Cotten and Ruth Work and Ray Collins. And then at the very end, there's just a couple extra credits thrown at the end. Just, you know, Kane, age 8, Kane. And then at the very bottom, it says Kane, age whatever, Orson Welles.
Yeah.
And he literally gets the lowest credit in the entire film. And it's like he's the star of the film. And I can only imagine, since seeing this movie in 1941, people must have been like, what is this guy doing? I mean, like, yeah. You know, and they said there's this playfulness to it that I found to be very charming in almost all of Orson's work. I call him Orson, whether it be his radio stuff or there's just a, I don't know, there's just like a twinkle in his eye the whole time, which I find very charming.
There's a moment like that has a similar sort of spontaneity in the film. There's this great scene where after Kane loses the election for governor, Jed Leland, his best friend, comes to, you know, he's just drunk as a skunk, and he gives him this whole beatdown and just tells him like exactly why and how he sucks as a person. And it's kind of a fascinating story about that scene is Joseph Cotten was starring in a play at the same time, and he had to fly back to New York to go star in the play. And so they shot this film. By the time they shot this scene, because they were trying to get it before Cotten flew away, Cotten had been up for literally like 24 hours. So he said, and he was playing drunk. So he said, by the time we shot that scene, I basically was drunk because I was so exhausted. And you see in his speech, he at one point, he's supposed to say dramatic criticism, but he stumbles over it and says dramatic crimitism. And he covers very quickly. He just goes, I am drunk. And you can see Wells just like, even though he's getting bawled out by his friend, Wells smiles very briefly. And they just keep on going with the scene. And it adds like a nice little charming moment to the scene that they wouldn't have gotten if he hadn't flubbed that one word. And it's a great spontaneous moment.
Yeah, it's an utterly real thing. Now, Bill, yeah. when you saw it for the first time, like, what was the context for you seeing it? Was it, you know, you were seeing it because it was called the greatest film of all time? Did you come out of it like that?
The first time I saw it, I was probably around 14, and a lot of the aesthetics flew past me. I basically viewed it as a conventional film, and it didn't register. A couple years later, when I was in college, it was a film class, and naturally it was on the roster. And the professor I had at the time, Harris Ross, had us listen to the film as well.
Mm.
Great idea.
Yeah, and in some context, you know, from Wells' background with Mercury Theater, but also in terms of how significant the sound choices are in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I definitely gained the appreciation I think most people have for it. If I could just comment on one thing there, where you were talking earlier about, you know, that this wasn't the biggest budgeted film and there were scenes that through visual trickery look like something different as they actually were with the paint matting with the crowd. My favorite scene along those lines is this one bit where Kane, Bernstein, and Leland have bought a newspaper, The Inquirer, and they're reflected in the office window of the Competitors magazine, Competitors newspaper, The Chronicle, and they're looking at a group photograph of the Chronicle staff, and both from an audio standpoint, because it's just some weird sounds going on at that point, and the slowness of the camera moving in on the photograph, and then it becomes a reflection of Kane and the other two, and then it flashes forward to a couple years later, and Kane has basically lured everybody away from the Chronicle to the Inquirer. I think that is masterful. It's a very short segment, but masterful filmmaking. And again, you know, based around economy, you know, it's basically just how the scene was shot and now exactly what went into the mechanics of the scene. Do you know what bit I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. They, and I think they ended up doing something like reverse printing where they took the film and then reared it backwards or something. There was some trickery there to get to be able to turn a live footage of these actors into a still photo and then did it backwards or something like that.
I think he basically just like printed a still from the sequence where Kane has bought out the entire staff, and he just printed that and then shot the earlier scene.
Right.
Yeah, there's a real joy to Citizen Kane, and there's something that I've been harping on throughout my watching movies, and now that, you know, over the Fire and Water podcast, is like, you know, movies can be about a downer subject, but if the film itself has a joy to it, and again, I don't mean that there's necessarily any happy scenes, but if there's a sense of exuberance in the making of the film, I feel that goes a long way to making it an enjoyable film. And like Orson, to me, the love of, I mean, Orson, the quote that is famous from Welles, he said when he came to California and went to RKO and was shown all the departments that he could use, the sound department, the special effects department, the matte painting, he said, this is the greatest train set a boy could ever have. Mm-hmm. And it has that feeling to it. It has that sense of like, wow, isn't this amazing? All the stuff you can do in a movie. You just feel it pouring through the every scene of this film, even though it's a fairly dark story about a young boy who is taken away from his mother and is given unimaginable wealth, but ends up ruining his, you know, corrupting his soul. I mean, it's a dark film, but yet you just don't get – it doesn't feel depressing. I feel like that about the work of Paul Thomas Anderson a lot. I feel like his films I feel like even though his movies are about heavy, dark subjects, there's just such a love of film that he has that it just, you just come away feeling like you're on a high, even though, boy, this is about a bunch of guys in the porn business, you know? Right. It just has that feeling to it. And it's – you know, Welles' subsequent films had a lot of that, but I don't think it was the same just because, you know, he didn't know what he was in for. I mean, he was spoiled by Kane, and he has said that in interviews where Kane really spoiled him because he thought all of his experiences would be like this.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and also I think there's that sort of youthful exuberance that you get.
Yeah, he was only 25, which is staggering.
That's something that just amazes me so much about that film is it's so adventurous and it's so knowledgeable about human nature, and I look at this and I'm like, it was done by a 25-year-old, and you know, I didn't know that much about people when I was 25. I don't think
I don't know that much now.
It amazes me that he was able, and I'm sure a lot of this is due to Mankiewicz as well, his contributions, but it is just very insightful about human nature, you know.
Yeah.
Right, and there's also such a muscularity to his sense of direction and such a confidence.
Yes.
That's a good word.
That I agree with you. It's amazing that someone this young could tell a story in this framework. But again, I'm in complete agreement with stuff that you guys have said just prior to this. There is that enthusiasm. There is that newness about working in a different medium than – in the case of Welles, theater or radio, that, you know, he basically had mastered also, again, at very young ages.
Yeah.
But there is that confidence. And I think that when you had mentioned Paul Thomas Anderson, Boogie Nights is, you know, very much a great-great-grandson of this film, that it hits on very dark subject matter, yet has a filter that finds the joy of what made these characters tick and what was good about them. Mm-hmm. And I think Kane does that in a maybe a little more subversive sense, but it definitely does it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely true. Now, I guess before we wrap up, I do want to ask you guys one thing about, you know what, Bill, you mentioned your favorite scene. John, do you have a favorite scene in particular?
That's not my favorite scene.
Oh, okay. What's your favorite scene?
My favorite scene is what effectively amounts to a throwaway line, but I think it gets to the humanity of the film, and a film really can't succeed if there isn't some sense of humanity in it. And there's a very brief throwaway line from Bernstein where he's talking to the reporter, and he mentions talking about memories and matters. Probably. And there's this line where he says he's talking about a girl that he saw when I think he was 9 years old or so. I'm not exactly remembering the exact line, saying that there isn't a week that goes by where he doesn't think of that girl.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she's everyone's had an experience like that.
A white parasol. He saw her. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And everybody in life has had a moment like that. That's, you know, we have big events in our lives where, you know, we may forget substantial details, but there may be something that was either unrequited or fleeting, but something small that had a grand impact on us that follows us. And I thought that particular bit, and I'm going to give that to Mankiewicz because you can see those sort of threads in other screenplays that he wrote that just really encapsulated a sense of humanity for that film in a really beautiful way.
And in a way, that's like one of the film's themes in Microcosm, in that like 1 minute monologue. It's how like a little thing that you might not think is a very important thing in the whole grand tapestry of someone's life, but that's the thing that Bernstein thinks about.
And I think there's analogs of that through the film with some of the other things in Kane's life.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. John, do you have a particular favorite scene that you think of?
Gosh, there's, I mean, like you guys were saying earlier, there's really no boring parts of Citizen Kane. You know, you can come into it literally any moment and just be like, oh, this is a great scene. I think, you know, maybe partly because it's fresh in my mind, I love that scene where Leland is dressing down his old friend Charlie Kane right after Kane loses the election. I think that's a pretty amazing scene, you know, and it's got some of the visual trademarks of Kane. It's got like it's shot at this very low angle. I think they actually had the camera on the floor for it. So like Kane's like this towering figure, and you know, but it's just a wonderfully scripted scene and beautifully performed as well. So I guess I'll at this moment I'll pick that one.
Yeah. And I also John, I also think that's testimony to how powerful repertory can be.
Yeah.
Of actors that are familiar with each other and know how to filter certain strengths out of certain actors for particular performances, and I love seeing those sort of moments on screen.
Yeah, it's great because the two of them are just batting that great dialogue back and forth, and it's wonderful to see.
Yeah, they are an amazing group of actors that he put together, and I mean, I've gone and tracked down some of the Mercury Theater broadcasts that he did, and it's just they handled all sorts of different stories. They did Dracula at one point. They adapted Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, and then they would also do
which he wanted to make into his first movie.
Right, right. They also did kind of silly stuff. I mean, they really could handle all sorts of things, and it was all of these same people, you know. And I actually. If I find an older movie that features one of these people from Kane, I'm a little more interested than I would have been without them in it. You know, I see some old movie and I'm like, oh, Edward Sloan is in it. I'm okay. You know, like it just has a little more interest. Now, before we say goodbye, did either of you guys continue on with Welles' other films? Like, did this inspire you to follow his other movies, or was Kane sort of a singular thing?
Oh, definitely. I mean, from Amberson's, I think, up to F for Fake, I've seen everything.
Yeah, I love, you know, Welles in general, and Touch of Evil is another one of my absolute favorite films. That's, you know, particularly the 1998 re-edit where they re-edited it according to the memo that Welles had written about how it should have been finished and how it wasn't back in the 50s. That's great. I actually just recorded Journey into Fear off of TCM the other night.
That's a good one.
So I'm looking forward to seeing that. And so I'm a fan of Welles in general. And, you know, not one that Welles directed, but another one with Welles and Cotton. I think you mentioned it earlier, The Third Man.
Yeah.
By Carol Reed. That's, what a great film that is.
Yeah. I tend to think of The Third Man as a Welles film.
Yeah. Well, he did contribute to it. He, you know, the cuckoo clock speech and all that. And it's you know, striking black and white photography. But
I mean, no offense to Carol Reed, but for some reason it's so consistent with other films, at least in terms of particular styles and touches and flourishes, that I often forget that it's not directed by Welles.
Yeah. I think a lot of people do that. You know, I have to remind myself sometimes. You know, another thing I find fascinating about Citizen Kane that I think we should talk a little about before we wrap it up is the comic book connection. This is a film that was really influential on an entire generation of artists, and even beyond that. I heard a quote, I forget where it originated from, it might have been Will Eisner or somebody, saying, you can't be a comic artist without seeing Citizen Kane. And I think, for me, like, you know, a future Kubert student, that was part of the reason I initially watched it. And it is amazing. You can see, like, you know, the very dramatic things in the lighting and the angles. And it is very melodramatic in places, and you can see how it influenced a whole generation of comics. And that's gone back and forth the other way. Is I've seen a lot of comics that have had a Citizen Kane connection. There was a Batman story that Brian Michael Bendis wrote called Citizen Wayne, that was sort of like a riff on Citizen Kane. Which was very interesting. There was apparently another story that Mark Waid and Brian Augustine did in a Legends of the Dark Knight annual. There was a Don Rosa Uncle Scrooge story that, and it, you know, it's amazing just to think of all the various tributes that you've seen to Citizen Kane in comic books through the years.
Right, and I can also appreciate that. I never really thought about that too much. I knew about the Bendis and the Eisner quote. But mm-hmm. when you think about this particular film, there's such an overload of shots, and taking the synergy between film storyboarding and comic books,
mm-hmm.
it's very comic booky.
Yes.
Because so many of the scenes are fleeting, yeah. and only addressed once. It's not as if it's a film with four or five sets.
Yeah.
That I never thought about that before, but yeah, wow.
I mean, all those low angles, all those you know, that film noir lighting. I mean, that's you look at, like, you know, the old spirit stories, and that's the sort of thing that Eisner was doing, and that's the sort of thing Bob Kane was trying to do in the old Batman stories that he was doing in the 40s. I mean, you can, if you're looking for it, you can really, really see it.
Oh, I always have drawn the parallel to me that the Will Eisner was the Orson Welles of comics.
Absolutely.
Know? Except he just managed his career a lot better. He had control over his art the way Welles did not, and that's why Eisner went on to this decades-long career as a, you know, everyone acknowledged he was the greatest ever, while Welles had to struggle a lot through his life, unfortunately. I mean, for a lot of people, you know, for a film that's constantly known as the greatest film that was ever made, I mean, Citizen Kane was not a hit when it came out. It didn't get a full release because it was supposedly based on the life of William Randolph Hearst, who had a lot of power back then, and made sure the film was A, didn't play in certain theaters, and B, didn't even get mentioned in Hearst newspapers. So yeah. A lot of people never saw it. And something else that Roger Ebert mentions, which is to me very instructive about how people it took a while to realize the brilliance of this film, was that whatever that magazine that rates the greatest films of all time, I forget what the name of that institution that decides that every year.
I think it was somewhere in France, actually.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, every year they do the greatest films of all time. And they come out with it every year. And from 1942 through 1955, Kane was not on the list at all, not in the top 10 or 20. And it wasn't until the mid-50s when the film was re-released. And by that point, Hearst's power had, you know, waned to where it didn't matter anymore. So then it was re-released. And all of these people that never saw it the first time went, oh, my God. And yeah. As of, like, from 55, for the next 60 years, it was the number one film.
Yeah.
So it was like, it did not appear on the list at all, and then it was number one in perpetuity. So it's,
well, I also think sometimes reappreciation is organic outside of the factors like the unavailability of a film. I think of something like Singing in the Rain, that it took people a long time to realize the craftsmanship behind musical making. So if you look at those same polls, Singing in the Rain is nowhere to be found until the late 60s.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, wow.
And then it ranks very highly.
It's kind of amazing how many of the films that we now regard as classics were not commercially successful when they were first released. I mean, The Wizard of Oz.
Yep.
That wasn't rediscovered until it was on TV. It's a Wonderful Life. Yep. That wasn't rediscovered until it went into public domain, and then it was on TV all the time.
Yep.
And, I mean, even like a more modern film like Shawshank Redemption.
Mm-hmm. Or Big Lebowski.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, those have become, like, these, you know, reappreciated cult films or mainstream successes. But they were not real successful when they were first released. It's funny how time lets you rediscover these things.
Yeah, and it was nice that Orson Welles, the reason I thought about doing Citizen Kane for the show this week was that this week that just passed would have been his 100th birthday.
Right.
He died relatively young at 70, but he did live long enough to see the film appreciated and people to know that for him to know that people regarded it so highly. And, you know, it's a shame that he didn't live longer to get to see people, you know, the DVD age and all the stuff, because he probably would have enjoyed how much people just completely – unbelievably worship this film, and I still do. Like I said, I just watched it again yesterday, and it's
can
just
you imagine
good.
What an Orson Welles commentary track on Citizen Kane would have been like?
I was just about to say,
I hate that he didn't live long enough to give us that. That would have been amazing.
Yeah.
He died in like 85, I remember.
Yeah, 1985. Yeah,
yeah, because it was. I think one of the last things he did, if not the last, was he did an introduction for that black and white episode of Moonlighting.
Yes, he did.
Like,
that's
big
right.
Show at the time, and they did. I forget exactly what it was called. I think it was like the flashback always rings twice or something like that. And yeah, they did like a film noir sort of episode, and from multiple viewpoints, kind of like Kane. So maybe that's why they thought of him to introduce that. I think that might have been his last on camera appearance.
Actually, I think he did a Merv Griffin. Yeah, he did a Merv Griffin.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Again, not a guy that took himself terribly seriously.
He filmed an interview and died hours later, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
Something like that. Yeah.
Just like John Lennon. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I love the fact that Welles' final film everyone likes to make fun of him. Oh, it's Transformers. It's not Transformers. It is not his last film. His last film is a Henry Jaglom film called Someone to Love, where he plays himself.
Uh-huh.
And his final, the last word he ever says on film is cut.
Wow.
Henry Jaglom allows him. That he knew that Orson probably wasn't going to live for too much longer. And he, at the end of the film, he basically says to Orson, well, why don't you say it? And Orson says it, and he doesn't quite say it right. And Jaglom says, say it again. And Welles goes, you want me to say it again? And Henry Jaglom goes, fine, cut. And then the film ends. And so that is literally the last thing Orson Welles says on film.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, anyway, that is Citizen Kane, guys. If any of you that have not seen it, please do. It really is. I mean, don't go into it thinking it's going to be the greatest film of all time, because no film can live up to that expectation. But it is a startlingly vibrant movie for it being so old and you know, just it's still fresh and still amazing. And it still remains one of my top 10 favorite films. And I will say that about 15 years ago, they opened an art house theater in our neighborhood, and to celebrate, it had like a 15 screens. It eventually became a multiplex of regular movies, but in the beginning, it was art house. And to celebrate the opening weekend, they ran older films, and they ran Citizen Kane. And I went and saw Kane 3 times in 2 days.
Wow!
I just was like, whenever am I going to get this chance again to see Citizen Kane? And I didn't get tired of it. I was like, I could keep watching this forever. It just works out so well. So Bill, John, I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on the show to talk about Citizen Kane. I think it says something about how much we love the movie that this show went on way longer than I had planned. but that's a good thing. It's always a good thing, though. So, you know, again, thanks again for coming on and talking about Citizen Kane with me.
Oh, thank you so much. I really thought the first time I would be on Fire and Water that I would be talking about Multiplex or Black Manta instead of Thatcher and Bernstein. But I'm very happy you invited me. This is really enjoyable.
Great.
Thanks very much, Rob. I had a great time.
Thanks, guys. And like I said, hope you come back for the next episode. In the meantime, go watch Citizen Kane.
Yeah. Or if you've seen it, watch it with the Ebert commentary track.
Or watch it again. Just go watch it.
Yeah.
Or turn your head around and listen to it.
Yeah.
That too.
Do all those things.
Do all those things this weekend. Go do all that.
Mr. Wells, is it all worth it?
It is when it works. You know, the one film of mine where I had total control, Kane, the studio hated it, but they didn't get to touch a frame. Ed.
Yes?
Visions are worth fighting for. Why spend your life making someone else's dreams?